What do Muslims want? Raymond Ibrahim writes, National View Online yesterday. Listen, this was a compelling piece. All humans generally live according to some set of priorities. A person may make a priority of health, of pleasure, of study, of almost anything, really. But it's practically a law of nature that a person must make a priority of something. Even those who lead unstructured existences unconsciously live according to some set of unarticulated priorities, if only according to something so basic as the primal need for food, drink, and shelter. For many people, religious practice, striving to obey God's commandments, is a high priority, the highest even. Yet this priority can come into conflict with the character of the society in which one lives. Raymond Ibrahim writes, this is undoubtedly the case for devout Muslims who voluntarily relocate to Western nations. This invariably will compromise what many of them profess to be their ultimate priority, living in accordance to the divine laws of Allah. That is, Sharia, most of which is derived from the words and deeds of 7th century Muhammad. Some of these Muslims arrive in the West and don't want to compromise. Consider some recent news stories. A few Muslim cashiers working at Target stores in Minneapolis are refusing to scan customer purchases that may contain pork. Instead of swiping the products themselves, which is their job, they are inconveniencing the customers or fellow employees by having them do it. Muslim cab drivers have long been discriminating against customers carrying or suspected of carrying alcohol. Officials at the St. Paul International Airport estimate that, on average, alcohol-bearing customers seeking cab rides are denied 77 times per month. Some blind customers have also been turned down on account of their seeing eye dogs. Muslims from Seattle have requested and been granted regularly scheduled hours for their exclusive use of public pools. An all-Muslim girls basketball team at a Chicago university demanded that men be barred from attending their matches. Some 200 Muslim women signed a petition at a Michigan fitness center demanding separate workout times for men and women, or at least the erection of a screen divider between the men's and women's section, which was also granted. All of these issues revolve around the Muslim desire to live according to Allah's laws, which, among other things, stay in contact with pigs, dogs, and alcohol, and have rigid social guidelines, especially concerning interaction between the sexes. So from a religious point of view, the antisocial behavior of these Muslims can be, if not excused, then certainly understood. They are doing only what their religion commands them to do, and their refusal to compromise on these points demonstrates that adherence to the commandments of Islam is a priority of the utmost importance to them. However, if living in strict accordance to Sharia is the first priority of some Muslim, one wonders, why have they voluntarily come and immersed themselves in infidel countries, quote-unquote, that do not recognize Sharia law and indeed allow many things that run counter to it, such as the selling and consumption of alcohol and pork and the liberal intermingling of the sexes? Most of the Muslim countries that Muslims abandon for the West are much more conducive to the Muslim lifestyle and uphold many, if not all, aspects of Sharia law. Yet each year, thousands of supposedly ultra-devout Muslims forsake these countries and, of their own free will, come and surround themselves with wine-imbibing, swine-eating libertines. Why? Of their own free will. Why? It's for the same reason that everyone else comes to the West, for the good life. They come in order to be prosperous and to enjoy opportunities, security, and equality, the likes of which they could never have in their own countries, ruled quite often, no surprise, according to Sharia. The vast majority of Muslims emigrating from the Islamic world do not leave due to necessity, such as oppression or starvation. No. They come to the infidel West solely to prosper materially. And then he asks, why are Muslims of the ultra-pious variety seeking after material comfort in the first place, especially when doing so will almost certainly undermine their professed desire to live strictly according to the Sharia? coming to live in a democratic country composed of some 300 million infidels is bound to affect any Muslim's observance of Sharia, is it not? Well, these pious Muslims risk coming into daily contact with not only pork, alcohol, and dogs, but all sorts of other defilements. Flamboyant homosexuals, scantily clad women, who are often in positions of authority, gamblers and usurers, to name a few. Are they not concerned that they, or especially their children, might be contaminated by the licenses and seductive practices of the infidel West? If their priority is truly to strictly follow Sharia, should they not remain in their Muslim countries of origin, with, if not as prosperous as the West, are definitely more conducive to the Muslim lifestyle? This is Raymond Ibram, National Review Online. He goes on. Or could it be that despite all the ruckus and subsequent headlines made by these Muslims, living in accordance to Allah and His Sharia is not really their first priority after all? At least, not to the degree they would be unwilling to put this priority at substantial risk for the sake of living the good life in a strictly secular and materialistic sense. Furthermore, if common sense does not dissuade them from relocating to the West, the very Sharia they claim to want to closely observe, certainly should. For instance, if pork and alcohol are condemned, Quran 5:4-2, section 219, voluntarily living among infidels, idolaters, and atheists is looked on no better. The Quran declares, O you who believe, take neither Jews nor Christians as friends. Whoever among you turns to them is one of them. 5, section 51. There are countless verses and traditions, in fact, that make it clear that Muslims are to be in constant state of animosity toward non-Muslims, waging war through tongue and teeth in order to spread Islam, and, when finally in a position of superiority, discriminating against those who refuse to convert. See, for example, he writes, 3, section 28, 5, section 73, 5, section 17, 9, section 5, 9, section 25 of the Quran. When the Meccans persisted in their unbelief, refusing to accept the prophethood and subsequent authority of Muhammad, he finally abandoned his kinfolks with these parting words, which some Muslims believe still define the proper relationship between Muslims and non-Muslims. Quote, we, Muslims, disown you, non-Muslims, and what you worship besides Allah. We renounce you. Enmity and hate shall forever reign between us until you believe in Allah alone. 60, section 40. So he writes, Raymond Ibrahim. So why are some Muslims making public scenes here in the United States over scanning bacon or transporting customers with sealed bottles of wine in their luggage while at the same time freely choosing to live with and, of course, benefit from those who they are commanded to hate and wage war upon, or at the very least disavow and be clean of? He says, quote, straining out a gnat while swallowing a camel, unquote, has long been a sure sign of hypocrisy. All Muslims who freely migrate to the West must understand that they can't have it both ways, that they can't have their cake and eat it too. They must choose between either strictly upholding the laws and customs of 7th century Arabia, in which case they should remain in their Sharia-friendly countries of origin, or, if prosperity and comfort is their first choice, let them relocate to the West, but prepare to assimilate. That is compromise, at least to some degree. It's a simple question of priorities. Raymond Ibrahim, National Review Online.